Welcome to episode 257 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be discovering what you can expect from a visit to Innsbruck in Austria. Plus, we find out more about the Northern Snow Show and learn why one ski company is handing over ownership to its staff. We also have snow reports from Down Under, your feedback, and for the first time this winter, I'm delighted to introduce Tirol in Austria as our official sponsor. And as regular listeners will know, the podcast takes me a huge amount of time to produce, so I really appreciate this support from Tirol. There are over 80 resorts there. Last winter, they welcomed over 6 million skiers. And our partnership means that we're going to have the opportunity to find out more about some of the great destinations in Tirol and how you can connect with the feeling of life that you can find there. Now, my name's Ian Martin. I'm joined by four guests in the studio today, so it's definitely a full house. Firstly, I'm delighted to welcome back Irish journalist Catherine Murphy for what I think is her sixth appearance on the show. She last joined us in episode 232 when she gave us an insight into the new Jondry 3S lift in Laidisaule. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Morning from Dublin. Sunny, cold Dublin.
Right. Well, sunny would be good. It's not very nice out of my window. We don't always catch you in Dublin. You're often travelling away overseas. Have you been away recently?
I was over and back to the Alps a little bit during the summer. I was in La Rosière, I was in Serge Vallier, and I was in Verbier. I have a few trips coming up now this weekend back to the Alps.
Wow. Well, that's not bad. Ski season hasn't even started yet. Let me introduce my other guest. So joining us today for what I think might be his third time on the podcast is Managing Director of Indoor Snow Slope, the Snow Centre, Ian Brown. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. Whereabouts are you today?
I'm having a rare day working from home today. There's a lot to do with prepping for winter season for both sites. So just a chance to catch up with some of the workload and some of the tasks to complete ahead of the launch of winter season.
Well, we're going to be discussing some of those tasks a little bit later on. But finally, I'm going to introduce my two first-timers to the show today. Founder of UK tour operator Peak Retreats, Xavier Schuller, and the company's new managing director, Alison Willis. Hi, Alison. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Yes.
Whereabouts are you?
So I'm in our offices on the South Coast in Portsmouth. And it is quite a grey day, but the wind's dropped, so my cycle in this morning was very pleasant.
Yeah, I am also further along the south coast, and it's good that the wind has dropped. It was ridiculously blowy earlier on this week. I was running into a 50-mile-an-hour wind, then turning around and feeling like Mo Farah on the way back earlier this week. Xavier, what about yourself? Where are you?
Yeah, good morning. I'm working from home on the Isle of Wight today, so it's... It's still pretty windy, but it's always windy on the Isle of Wight.
Right. A question I always like to ask my guests to start off with is, when did you ski or snowboard last? Catherine, you've been out the Alps in the summer. Were you skiing on any of those, or when were you last on snow?
No, my last time on snow was the first week of April in Courchevel.
Beautiful. Okay, Ian, what about yourself? Perhaps you were last on snow in one of your own venues.
Yeah, in terms of the actual Alps, it was the Snow Camp Three Valleys event at the end of April, which was fantastic. And yes, of course, I've had a couple of practice sessions both in Manchester and Hemel over the summer just to try and keep those legs moving.
I've had several guests where their last skiing was the Snow Camp event in Val Thorens. I guess it happened towards the end of the season, but evidently it was a big event. And I'm not sure if we're going to touch on this later, but the Snow Centre in Hemel Hempstead is one of the areas that Snow Camp use quite a lot.
Yeah, both centres, Ian. So Manchester and Hemel, they run their apprentice programmes out of both our sites, have done for many years, very successful, and we're very happy to be partners with them. It's a great charity.
Oh, well, I think I mentioned before, regular listeners will know, the last time I skied was when I was skiing around all of the UK's snow domes in a single day. That included skiing at the Snow Centre and Chill Factory as well. What about yourself, Alison? When were you last on snow?
My last time on snow was a team trip to Tien, which takes place. We'd normally try to get as many of the team as possible out to the Alps at the end of the season. So we were in Tien towards the end of April and had a fantastic time. Great snow. Really nice to, you know, be out there with all the team experiencing, living what we sell our clients the rest of the season.
Yeah, difficult when you work in the ski industry and you're selling holidays to find the opportunity to get everyone away during the winter. Xavier, were you on that trip as well? Was that your last skiing?
I was indeed. Normally, I like to end the season in either Val Thorens or Chamonix-Argentière in early May. This year was also on the same trip as Alison at the very end of April in Tignes.
That's interesting you mentioned there about Gros Monte or Jonthière Glazing, because I'm not sure I've mentioned this on the podcast yet, but next winter I'm going to be spending a couple of months out in Chamonix. Ooh. And I will be there for the final day. I've kind of read about it a bunch of times. I'm hoping to go up there. I don't think I'll be doing attempting to ski across the water, which is one of the things they do. Have you ever tried that or watched that?
I've seen that in Tignes, and my son has done it on a snowboard, but it's not for me.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be for me either, unless it's an incredibly warm day. Right. Well, there is skiing going on around the world right now. Thanks to some great snowfall, the snow season down under could go on for another month. Let's have a listen to the latest update from Miss Snow It All, Rachel Oakes-Ash from snowsbest.com.
Well, it really does feel, Ian, as though the season is wrapping itself up in Australia and New Zealand with torrential rain in the past week, but that was followed by predictable snow in both countries' ski resorts. Now, according to some sources, New Zealand has had its best ski days of the season in the past couple of days, and there's more on the way. Aussie resorts are holding out for around anything from 5 to 10 or 10 to 20 centimetres this coming weekend. Whether it will be rain or snow, slush or sleet, we're yet to find out how Ulla decides to turn up. While Queenstown is also hoping for more top-ups on Sunday, that could bring a good dumpage to the likes of Treble Cone. You know the season is ending when pond skims come to play, with resorts enjoying fancy dress and springtime parties. The stomping ground at Thredbo has now packed up and they've headed to Switzerland, where the world's best will be training for big air, slopestyle and halfpipe ahead of the Livigno Winter Olympics in February. And now Australia's much-lauded mogul skiers will be making their way to Finland for the training camp, while the equally lauded aerial skiers are currently training in China. So it's all eyes on the Northern Hemisphere.
We're recording this today on Wednesday, the 17th of September, and I read in the news this morning that Robert Redford, the actor, died. I think possibly listeners may be familiar with a movie that he made in 1969, which is called Downhill Racer. To my mind, that is the best movie ever that's been made about skiing. And I just wanted to mention it. You can look it up in various places and watch it online. It's extremely good in terms of the footage that includes. It incorporates real World Cup footage from races. And then on location in Kitzbühel, St. Anton, Wengen, Grindelwald, and Megève. So have a look for that one, listeners, if you want to see a great Robert Redford movie. Now, last week in episode 256, we covered the London Snow Show. But while around two-thirds of our listeners are in the UK, I recognise that not everyone is in reach of London. And the good news is there's also a Northern Snow Show as well, taking place at the Chill Factory Indoor Snow Slope next month. Now, I wanted to let listeners know a little bit more about it. Who better than Ian, who's joined us today? For context, listeners might not realise that Chill Factory in Manchester and the Snow Centre in Hemel Hempstead are both part of the same company. And in fact, why don't we just start with that? Because I think there's a rebranding process going on, isn't there? Chill Factory may not be Chill Factory for much longer. Is that right, Ian?
Well, as of yesterday, Ian, it became Snow Centre Manchester. You know, we joined forces back in March 21 at the end of lockdown, and we've spent 4 years, two good businesses becoming one even better business together, sharing best practice, sharing our culture, sharing our philosophy. And it was just a natural progression with the rebrand. And it's not just a rebrand as in Snow Centre, but we've also updated the Snow Centre logo in Hemel as well. So guests will see at both sites a new image and a new brand.
I'm going to say I obviously deliberately invited you on because I knew that rebrand was officially happening yesterday, but that's just a lucky accident. Interesting then, I can see advantages to having the same brand. And I think if anyone has seen previously Chill Factory, I mean, it has, as you drive past it on the motorway, it's so prominent, you know, it really does stand out. Snow Centre Manchester then is going to be hosting the Northern Snow Show. So I wondered if you could just give us some of the basics.
This is year two. You know, we did it last year for the first time, hosting an event in the north, and a real leap of faith in hosting such events. And a big thanks to all the brands and guests who came last year. Overwhelming success, really positive feedback from guests who attended, and in particular the brands. So here we go. Year two. It's on the 4th and 5th of October. 10 till 6 on the Saturday, 10 till 4 on the Sunday. And we've got over 50 snow sports brands represented. In effect, we've sold out all the space that we have. And we have everything from taster sessions happening on the slope. You can take equipment out for taster sessions. We're doing special offers on lift passes. And we have retail brands, holiday brands, and equipment brands. So a real mix for the whole weekend.
One thing that you haven't mentioned there is that my understanding is that Dave Riding is going to be there at the beginning of the show, opening it and available for autographs. Is that right?
Absolutely. He's opening the show, also doing coaching sessions, and he'll be part of the fireside chats over the weekend as well. So people can come and meet him and hear some of his stories.
He's doing coaching sessions. How's that going to work? Will you have to book in advance? Is there still space for that? I'd love to be coached by Dave Riding.
Yeah, we've got different coaches out there. We've got Dave Riding. We've got Jamie Nichols. We've got Warren Smith. And we've got our two resident in-house head of snow sports in Pete Gillespie for ski and Kev Edwards for snowboard. So there's an array of activities for guests to come along and participate on the slopes.
Cool. That sounds great. Regular listeners will know Warren Smith recently re-released the interview I did with him. And Jamie Nichols is an ex-Olympian snowboarder as well. What about getting in then? What's the cost for this? Because normally if you go along, you've got to pay to get on the slope. So how does it work for the Northern Snow Show?
Well, I'm pleased to say it's actually free to attend. So there's no cost to come to the event. We do have £20 premium tickets. You receive a goodie bag because a number of the brands have put some products together. So we can give away goodie bags. It also gives you a voucher to spend in snow centres. And also we're donating 10% of those ticket sales to Snow Camp and DSUK as our charity partners. In terms of the slope, we're doing special offers. There's £25 for a 1 hour lift pass or 39 for two. And that gives you access to the brands on the slope. And then you can test equipment out on the real snow.
You know, it sounds great. I know it's the second year, and like last year, really just an experiment. Obviously went well. Is there like a capacity issue? You must have like a limited number of tickets that you can sell.
It's several hundred can come in at any one time. Obviously we've got the street up in Manchester and there'll be a lot of brands out on the street. We can have a couple of hundred out on the slope. So, you know, we are expecting a big turnout, but given the space that we have, we think it will just create a fantastic vibe right across the centre.
Oh, well, I look forward to hearing how that goes. I don't know that I'm going to be able to make it this year, but hopefully it sounds like it's going to be going ahead next year as well. That's brilliant, Ian. Thank you very much for updating us on that and the rebranding for the Snow Centre as well. Just back to the London show for a minute. That's about 4 weeks away now. Just want to remind listeners they can check on the latest news and get a free ticket code by taking the link in the show notes. I've already mentioned that our equipment expert, Al Morgan, and I will be covering the best of this year's new kit on Saturday morning at the show. You can get ahead of that by making sure you listen to next week's episode when Al and I will be looking at the best new skis for 2026. Right. Let's move on to Austria, and specifically Innsbruck, capital of Tyrol, sponsors of the Ski Podcast this winter. I went to Innsbruck in 2017. I had to look it up. That was on the way back from a trip to Kutai, which is about 40 minutes away from Innsbruck itself. Obviously, you could take a city break there, but I think it's a great way to top and tail a ski trip. Catherine, when were you in Innsbruck?
I was last there in January 2024, Ian, so not too long ago.
So was that on before or after a ski trip, or were you specifically just going to look at Innsbruck itself?
I was there to see Innsbruck and to ski, so to experience the whole city and ski, you know, unique selling point that Innsbruck offers.
So therefore, talking about the city itself then and thinking about that, what kind of stands out to you about Innsbruck as a destination?
I mean, it's the very centre of Europe, isn't it? It's very close to the German-Italian borders and a couple of hours away from Salzburg, Vienna, Verona. It's a gateway to the Alps and it's a medieval city. It's just bursting with history. You know, emperors and empresses of the Habsburg Empire. It was the former capital of Austria, Europe and the Roman Empire back in the Middle Ages. So just teeming with history and historical sites and a small, easily walkable city.
Well, I was there with my kids. And so just doing the maths, that was 8 years ago. So they were probably about 10 at the time. They were less keen on seeing some of the museums and some of the history that's there. I guess the most famous thing we saw, which was more kind of appealing to them, was the golden roof, which I don't think is actually gold at all, is it? They're like copper tiles, but you can see that from the outside.
You do. I mean, the golden roof, they're gilded copper shingles, and it's not actually a massive roof. It's quite a small section of a roof. It basically is a symbol of power for Emperor Maximilian I, who was the ruler of the Habsburg and Roman empires back in the 1500s, if I've got that right. It is the most popular attraction in the city. Personally, not my favourite. My favourite, I think I've told you before, is the Hofkirche, which is the Royal Court Church. And it's the cenotaph or the tomb of Maximilian I. He's not actually buried there, but it's an incredible place to visit. I think we're talking about the 28 bronze statues that were designed as funeral. This is very jolly ski talking. Funeral escorts for the emperor. But it's just the most incredible place. I'm not religious, but I sat through a mass in German just to be in the presence of these bronze statues. Incredible place. And if you're interested in that kind of thing, give yourself lots of time to visit and to study the statues.
Yeah, I agree with you. I certainly remember that. And, you know, one of these little frustrations of being with younger children, it wasn't quite within their attention span because, as you say, they're these huge bronze figures. I guess it's obvious that it would be the sort of place where there'd be a mass. When I was there, it felt more like a tourist attraction that you would visit per se. But yeah, they're very detailed. And then each of the guards that are standing around have a bunch of information about who inspired them, including a number of women who were part of his life as well.
Yeah, basically the statues represent his relatives, his ancestors and his role models. So the legendary King Arthur is there. His father is represented and his daughter Margaret is represented. I'm not sure who the other seven female statues are. There's a mass every day in the church. Probably since you've been there, Ian, they've introduced a very interesting educational interactive introduction to the church, which is actually very good fun for children and for families. So that's very appealing. I think what I find interesting is during World War II, the statues were removed from the church and hidden in mountain caves. And some local Innsbruckers in their 80s still remember those statues being brought back into the city when the war had ended. Relatively unscathed, and they're just a very important historical site within Europe.
I did not know that. That's really interesting. I think one thing that, you know, was very interesting to me about Innsbruck, and certainly, you know, appealed for the whole family, is that, okay, you have that ancient history, but there's a real mix with the modern as well. There's a lot of very stylish modern buildings in the city, and particularly, some of them are designed by a British architect, Zaha Hadid. The funicular that goes up in the Nordkette direction. Some of those funicular stations are really outstanding.
Yeah. I mean, Congress Station, as you say, was designed by Hadid, and she's also the designer behind the jump tower and the Bergiesel ski jumping stadium, which we'll talk about in a little while. But yeah, it's quite incredible. I mean, her design of the funicular station in Innsbruck is based on a glacier and is meant to flow like a glacier. And it's very contemporary. And that is the beauty of, as you say, the mix of ancient and modern in Innsbruck, that you can be in the city centre or in the old town, have your breakfast and a morning coffee, and then step into Congress Station on a funicular up towards Nordkette.
There's obviously a reason why I invited you on, because you give me a lot of information that either I never learned at the time or I've completely forgotten. But now you say it was inspired by a glacier, it kind of makes sense. And listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes so you can have a look at this and get a real sense of it. You mentioned the ski jump. That's also designed by her. And that's another very spectacular modern building. I haven't been there. Did you go to that at all?
I've been twice. I've been in summer and winter. So it's incredible. The jump tower designed by Hadid is nicknamed the Cobra because of the shape of it. And it's when you're downtown Innsbruck, it's visible from the city centre, which is in a very subtle, nice way. So it's iconic. And then when you go up to, I think even if you're not a ski jumping or a ski fan, going up to the stadium, you might be by the time you leave. It's just fascinating. You've got to book early. You can do breakfast at the stadium. There's fabulous views of Innsbruck City, first of all. The breakfast is a feast. And then if you're part of a group, you can book an experience where you get to meet a ski jumper. We met a former pro called Thomas Hofer, a lovely guy in his late 20s. And you get to sit on the tremble bank, which is where the athletes sit, obviously, before they jump. And as someone who has a fear of heights, that was quite a challenge for me. It's really a spectacular thing to do. And interestingly, Ian, as the athletes are jumping, there's a cemetery right in front of the stadium. So they're actually jumping towards the cemetery. I'm full of the joys of living today, Ian.
Sorry, Kev, just to track back. So yeah. The bit that you went out to, which you described just then as the tremble bank, is that a translation or is that how you feel when you're an English speaker sitting on the top there?
It's absolutely how I felt anyway. Other people in the group didn't seem to have any problems. It's literally a bench that you're clipped in, you're harnessed, you're completely safe. But you still have that feeling of height at altitude. And if you have a fear of heights, it's a little bit uncomfortable. And, you know, people were asking us to turn around, have your photograph taken. And that was quite challenging for me. But really, really fascinating to talk to Thomas about everything involved with ski jumping, with their diet, with the training, with the visualization techniques that they use before jumping. Just really fascinating and well worth a visit. They've hosted Olympic events there. They've had a papal visit. Just to continue with the religious theme, Ian.
Actually, Rob Rees has reported for us before about the Four Mountains competition, and one of those takes place there. So I think I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. What about the ski areas then? I was in Kutai. That's about 40 minutes from Innsbruck. So therefore, short transfer, it's high, is the reason I went there, about 2,000 metres. And again, I was with the kids. We actually went there for the jump. They were filming the jump. It was the last series that ever took place. Very exciting. I got to meet people like Bradley Wiggins and Lewis Smith and Davina McCall and others. We got into the chalet and featured briefly on TV, which was very exciting for the kids. But, you know, Kutai, I really enjoyed skiing there. The highlight, again, for them was night skiing. Opens up in the evening. Quite a big area, quite a big descent that you can do night skiing. Did you go up to Kutai at all?
I did. We spent a morning skiing Kutai. And I think that the two standout things for me, we had a very young ski instructor. Our ski instructor was still in school. She was 18 years old. And while we were having lunch, we sat, there's a dam, and we sat and watched people skiing along the dam. I don't know how that's possible, but they were doing it. I really enjoyed Kutai. And then some of our group went tobogganing in Kutai. Myself and a friend decided to take a little short ski bus ride down to an area that's linked to it, which is, my pronunciation would be terrible, it's Hokots. And that was a nice, another small family-friendly tree-lined ski area, which was really nice. Of course, the unique selling point with Innsbruck, unique in the world, I believe, ski plus city pass Stubai Innsbruck, I think is the correct title, which gives people unlimited access to 12 ski resorts plus access to the Stubai Glacier, but also one-off visit access to 23 attractions within the city of Innsbruck. So it's quite unique.
I think it might be called the Ski Plus City Pass. I'm not 100% sure, but it covers all of those areas, the 12 areas, including Stubai that you mentioned where they have a glacier. That's about 40 minutes away. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. A lot of those ski areas are very, very near to Innsbruck. That's why this kind of city ski combination works quite well. I think you've been to, and neither of us are sure of the pronunciation, but it's at Aksamerlitsum.
Yeah, Aksamerlitsum. I listened to the pronunciation today. Yeah, basically six of the resorts are in and around Innsbruck. We visited Nordkettle but didn't ski there. I've skied in Mutteraram, which is probably the closest, Aksamerlitsum, which is about 20 kilometres only from the city, and then Kutai. All family-friendly ski areas.
Mutteraram, more beginners and children. But Aksamerlitsum?
Yeah, which we were talking about this, has, I think it's 40 kilometres of pisted runs. The day we skied there, we'd kind of claggy, cloudy, dampy weather, but it has a freestyle area. It's got it's snow park, I think it's called the Golden Roof Park, which is a reference obviously to the Golden Roof in Innsbruck. And it also has a pretty big free ride area, which I didn't get to sample, unfortunately, but that's what that area is known for.
Yeah, and that's only 15 minutes away. Nordkettle that you mentioned, if you took that funicular, we talked about the designs of the stations up, and then you get a cable car, go up to Nordkettle. It's immediately above Innsbruck. Again, I went up there. I didn't ski there because that's more kind of testing. There are some basic slopes up there, but
yeah,
some of the shots that I've seen, you know, when the snow is good, I've talked to people who've been based in Innsbruck, and you can ski right down to the bottom, and some amazing shots of people skiing with the city in the background.
Exactly. I think a lot of people take that, you know, the funicular and cable car. And by the way, the whole ride up is accessible for wheelchair users or reduced mobility visitors. So a lot of people go up just to have lunch and to enjoy the great views over the city. Yeah, what I've been told is that Nordkette is good for beginners, but then it gets into steeper off-piste or ski touring terrain.
Yeah, well, that would be the appeal to me down the track when I go out there. That's brilliant, Catherine. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to put a link to a bunch of those things that Catherine mentioned in the show notes. But if it's okay, I'm going to turn to Xavier and Alison just now. We touched on this earlier, but I mentioned in episode 256 that one of the most interesting conversations I had at Ski Launch was about Peak Retreat's decision to become the only UK ski company to be employee-owned. Senior management are stepping up as directors. Alison, I think you're going to become managing director. And I would like to ask you about that new setup. But before that, Xavier, I wondered if you could give us some background to the company. I think you set up Peak Retreats with your co-founder in 2002, or was it earlier than that?
Yeah, that's right, Ian. It was 2002 when my co-founder, Natalie, we launched the business. At the time, both of us were into tour operating, and Natalie was into skiing, so managing a French tour operator that was based in the UK, and I was in more sort of summer kind of tour operating. And what we'd noticed at the time was that all the UK tour operators were featuring about, you know, like a dozen resorts, and that was it. I've been lucky enough to have skied in France since the age of sort of five. My father was in education, so I had quite a bit of a spare time holidays, and you know, we were lucky to go as children, you know, like three times a year skiing in France, and you know, we would go to different resorts every time. And I've been to so many resorts, you know, in France. I knew that, you know, there was something like 300 resorts. And we couldn't understand why, you know, nobody was featuring a lot of these smaller resorts and just the sort of dozen big resorts. You know, we started to do a bit of investigating, and we had friends in other tour operators, and they all said to us, total waste of time, you know, nobody's interested in those resorts, we've tried, but we thought, no, I mean, it's definitely something there. And what we knew at the time was that some of these smaller resorts, which were more traditional, where French people were going, were becoming linked to major ski areas. So for example, if you take resorts like Morillon or Samoins, Les Carreaux in the Grand Massif ski area. So all the operators would feature Flaine, but nobody had heard about Samoins or, you know, Les Carreaux. And we thought, well, that's a great opportunity, you know, to bring sort of new resorts to the UK market with a different perspective, more traditional villages, but still with access to big ski area. At first it was quite difficult because, I sold my house to finance the business. So it was big, massive risk there. You know, I gave ourselves sort of 2 years. And I thought, well, if we haven't made it in 2 years, you know, we'll have to try something else. But it took off very, very quickly. I think it was just the right time as well. People wanted something different. Within 1 year, we were already sort of on a good trajectory.
I think that shows that from an entrepreneurial point of view, that there's no risk, no reward. You know, you took a gamble there and it paid off from your instinct for the market. I mean, you mentioned Samoin. I mean, these days there's a Club Med, I think, over in Samoin. There are other resorts that have been included into the larger ski areas. And I think anticipating the market has obviously been a real key point for you. The company's become very successful. I think it's grown hugely. I think you probably have a very loyal customer base. And I noticed as well that you're a regular winner of awards.
Indeed, yeah. No, we've won the best ski company from the Telegraph, which was voted by the readers for the third time now. So it's something we're, you know, extremely pleased about. And you know, as you said, we've business you know, has grown, you know, a lot from these early days. And we've broadened the resorts we feature.
So after 20 years of running the business, I guess like maybe Logan Roy or King Lear, at some point thoughts turn to succession. For some people, that means selling the company. So What led you to decide to pass on the company to the employees rather than sell it?
You know, we came to the sort of age where we did think about succession, you know, plans. We were not in a hurry, but we thought, well, within the next 10 years, you know, we would like to do something else maybe. I mean, one of the obvious options was to sell the business, and we were approached by a number of companies to sell the business, and we could have probably maximized the amount of money we could have made, you know, by selling the business to a bigger group. But we're very fortunate, so Pictree, that we've had extremely loyal team. Almost 50% of the staff been with us nearly like pretty much 10 years, and the whole spirit of Pictree, you know, is the team. You know, that's what made the company successful. And what we didn't want was for the company to you know, become absorbed in a bigger group and to lose its kind of ethos, and that's why you know, we decided to look at alternatives.
Yeah, that's interesting. Having been through the process of you know, selling a company, you know, back when I sold Natives in the early 2000s, it was interesting to see how, despite the efforts I made to try and keep the culture of the company the same, it changed very quickly, and you know, actually isn't in business anymore. And if listeners have listened to episode I think it's 252, the Bladenline story, rise and fall of Bladenlines, and you know, you've got a company there that was the largest ski company in Britain that didn't exist after it got bought. So sometimes, you know, these things can change. But maybe Alison, I could bring the conversation onto you. I wonder if you could explain to us then exactly what has changed. How does an employee-owned company work?
So, yeah, the employee ownership model means that everything is basically held collectively on behalf of the employees. So it's like there's a lot of companies that have gone down this route. Most famously, I think, John Lewis, which is the longest established employee-owned company in the UK. But recently, or more recently, people like Richer Sounds, GoApe, Riverford Organic Farmers, there's a lot of companies. I think there's over 2,400 companies now that are employee-owned in the UK. And the reason is because, it, as Zadia said, it's a really positive way to ensure succession doesn't, you know, lose the company, its culture and its ethos.
And I think I've read studies that show it's beneficial for both employees and the business because you end up with better productivity.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's studies that say that employee-owned businesses are, everyone's more productive because everyone's more engaged, because everyone has a stake in the business. And also, I think there's evidence that employee-owned businesses can make more socially conscious, environmentally conscious, sustainable and ethical decisions because they are not looking at making profit for faceless investors. They're looking at benefiting the employees in the long term. And I think although 0.1% of the UK workforce work in employee-owned businesses, it contributes 0.8% to the economy. So it's still a small business, but it's outsized compared to the amount of work the workforce that's in it.
Okay. And you mentioned profit there. I mean, ultimately, how will you decide between you whether to reinvest profits or to distribute them amongst the employees?
I think because we're all in it for the long term, so we are here not to take money out of the business, but to invest in the business. That's going to be a key driver in our decision making. So we anticipate, you know, we'll be investing in new product and new technology, because as a team, we want to make the business sustainable in the long term and just keep growing. So I think that's why in reinvestment is going to be the core of what we do, because it's not just about making profit. It's about investing to create the ski holidays that are right for our clients, and in resorts and in with the sort of ethos that we're known for.
And I believe when I was researching this, there is an organization which brings together lots of the employee-owned companies, so you can liaise with them to work on best practice.
Yeah, the Employee Ownership Association is a fantastic resource. So they did a podcast, actually, that I've listened to every single episode of. It's got real life stories from other employee-owned businesses. And one of the things I think that they've all said that came across really clearly is it's not something that happens overnight. You become employee-owned, but you have to work at it. It's like anything. You have to basically kind of instill that, maximize the employee voice and instill that open culture into the business. You know, we are an open business, and the team, as they have been very loyal for a long time. We've got a lot of established people who've been with us a long time, so it's easier to do that, but it's still kind of changing that mentality to think of yourself as an employee owner rather than just an employee.
It'll be really interesting to see how that progresses. And Xavier, I happen to know that you spend a lot of your time cycling, so will that allow you to spend even more time out on the road?
Yes, definitely. But I'm still staying with the business, not in a management capacity anymore, but I'll be helping the business with a number of things, number of projects for, you know, number of years. I mean, one thing we've set up, for example, is a new cycling challenge to run in Alpe d'Huez next June. The idea being, you know, everyone knows Alpe d'Huez, you know, very famous OC ski resort, but it's also the most mythical, it's kind of legendary climb used by Tour de France cyclists. Our idea is that we've set up this challenge where people will be able to have a go at going up and down the 13-kilometer climb as many times as they can in one day. You're talking about 1100 meters of elevation each time you go up, so it's quite a big challenge.
I think most people would be happy just to do it once. I've cycled up there a couple of times myself, although both times were actually as part of a triathlon, which they do over there in the summer. So you swim, then you cycle up to Alpe d'Huez, then you do a run at the top. But I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. Cool. Well, that's brilliant, Alison and Xavier, and thanks for sharing that. Really interesting story. We're just going to move towards the close now. I always enjoy listener feedback. Love to hear what you think about the show. You can leave me a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or you can drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. Colin Slater sent me a message saying, just discovered the podcast and listened to loads of them now. Love the Blade and Lines one. He also mentions he now works on the ski patrol at Glencoe, and he has requested a Scotland feature, which is a great idea, and we'll try and fit one of those in before the season starts. And Glenn Westrup said, I've really enjoyed Rachel's snow reports from Australia and New Zealand, and I'll second that. They are extremely good and very detailed. There are now 272 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 128 of those are listened to in the last week. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something you will want to listen to as well. In the last week, around 60% of our listeners were in the UK, around 15% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as India, Brazil, and Azerbaijan. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at the Ski Podcast. You can follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of each podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. And if you enjoyed this episode and would like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget you can help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money on your ski hire by using the code SKIPODCAST when you book at InSportRent.com. You'll get a guaranteed additional discount, or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Right. I would like to thank my guests from today. Now, Ian has actually left us already. He had to go on to call with Dave Riding. But Catherine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Hopefully we'll have you on the show again this winter when you cover some of your mini trips. Alison, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
And Xavier, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Ian. Enjoyed being on the Ski Podcast.
Thank you. Finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.